Hello and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and today we have from December 2nd, 2008, Scott Horton interviews Chris Hedges. Chris Hedges discusses the anti-occupation motives of terrorists, the similarities of extremists that transcend religion and culture, and how a U.S. economic collapse could usher in a popular uprising of the Christian right. The entire interview is about 36 minutes.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, for the audience not familiar, this is not coming from a Marxist atheist type by any means, right, Chris?
No, it really was learned the hard way, which is standing on the other end of American ordinance around the world and watching what we did to other people. I'm a seminary graduate and, you know, very anti-utopian, whether that's the utopianism of the left or the right.
Yeah, well, and you know, we talked with a minister yesterday here on the show by the name of Bill Barnwell, who is a Protestant minister who's very critical of the sort of pseudo-theology of the Left Behind series and worries of the end times and the Antichrist and discussing, you know, the political influence of that particular faction of American Christianity. Do you think that's really still on the march, like when you wrote American Fascists, or do you think that the recent election marks any sort of real setback for that movement?
No, I don't think. Well, I suppose the election marks a temporary setback, but the engine of the movement is personal and economic despair, primarily economic, and with the economic meltdown, you are seeing the working, especially the working class of this country, driven to real desperation, and that is the fuel of this movement.
It's almost like the Indian ghost dance or something.
Well, there's a lot of that. I mean, you know, that because you're leaving a reality-based world, which doesn't work for you, and to embrace a world of magic and, you know, divine intervention, apocalyptic glory, and weird stories of the creation of the Earth 6,000 years ago. And, you know, it's a fantasy. It's a mythology. And it's irrational. And that's what happens when people are pushed to an extent, to that extent. I mean, totalitarianism itself is a severance of a reality, from a reality-based world. The exaltation of the self, you know, your own destiny determined either by history or God or, and so I think that, in fact, the economic turmoil that we're undergoing is only going to empower the movement. These movements thrive on crisis, and they thrive on despair, and we've got lots of both right now.
Mm. Yeah, that really has been, for me, the most striking thing of this last era, maybe just kind of, being an adult now and really seeing, I don't know to what degree it's always been this way, not just people who have different faiths and believe different things than me or whatever, but people really willing, adults willing to, and masses of them together, you know, entire kind of segments of society, it seems like, willing to completely escape to a fantasy world where, you know, I heard that Barack Obama might be a friend of Osama bin Laden and an Al-Qaeda terrorist, and where, you know, never mind all the million things that would that are true that would have to not be true for that to in order to be the case. I mean, really, if he was a terrorist, why wouldn't the Democrats have nominated Hillary Clinton instead? I mean, come on, what we're talking about? Just, you know, comic book reality here for I don't know how many people, maybe everybody.
Well, tens of millions of people in this country, you know, who get all of their news and information and spiritual guidance and entertainment through this distorted prism of Christian radio and television. It's terrifying, and it is completely disconnected from the real world.
Yeah, you know, sorry to just kind of be so far afield here, but I had a friend in the county jail serving some time for a DWI, and he talked about the rough treatment that was given someone who was being uncooperative, but they basically tied him in a chair and put a leather mask over his face like Hannibal Lecter and all this, and just kind of left him tied up there. And it sort of brought to my mind, you know, all the experiments where they prove how willing Americans can be, and just the drop of a hat to turn on each other. And, you know, here these local sheriff's deputies basically are people in my neighborhood, and they're willing to tie a man down in a chair and leave him there for 6 hours, where, you know, probably his spine is being bent out all shape, out of shape. Apparently he was yelling over and over, "Why am I still in torture?" And then, "Why am I still in torture? How quiet do you want me to say it? Please let me out of torture," he was saying. And they left him there. My neighbors, the Travis County Sheriff's deputies, left this guy there for 6 hours in the Travis County lockup, as though handcuffs just aren't good enough inside the jail. And I'm thinking, especially when you talk about people this detached from reality, how easy, you know, you write this book, American Fascist, how easy would it really be to turn these people into some sort of, you know, Blackwater Army against the rest of us?
Well,
some sort of black shirt.
Blackwater's run by one of the premier or the charter members of the radical Christian right, Eric Prince. And the rise of a mercenary force, which is now has three bases on American soil, it isn't completely terrifying because it is wedded to that ideology and disconnected from any kind of constitutional control or oversight. So, yeah, I mean, I think what you learn when you cover as many countries as I have is that you can, you know, raise these kinds of inhuman organs in any society, and our society is certainly not exempt from that, as your story illustrates.
Well, you know, they talk about sort of the defining characteristics of fascism and that kind of thing. In your travels and covering all these wars, do you see America really starting to fit into the pattern of, you know, say, South American banana republics of the 70s and 80s and states in the Middle East today? Are we really heading down the path toward the abandonment of law and the empowerment of a real total state in this society, Chris, you think?
As long as our oligarchic elite continues to rob us blind and funnel, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars upwards to Wall Street, and probably the largest transference of wealth from the base to the pinnacle in American history, you know, what they're really doing is accelerating the collapse of the system. I mean, the idea that, you know, we can throw enough money at anywhere $3 to $4 trillion worth of bad assets and make a difference. You know, the issue is, the most astute economists have pointed out, is that people can't pay their mortgages. They can't pay their credit card bills. And banks are not lending because they understand full well that most of these loans are not going to be paid back. So we haven't even begun to address the issue. And the longer we allow economic elites, you know, all of them wedded to Wall Street, to continue this fantasy that we can sustain an economy through borrowing and consumption, that's the kind of disconnect from reality, the faster we accelerate our own internal disintegration.
Well, right, and then the question is, what comes after that? When you have the next Great Depression, if that's indeed what it is, if the recession, the attempt to reinflate continues to fail and the whole thing really unravels. And
it already is failing.
Right. Well, so if we have massive unemployment, 25% or better, that kind of thing, that's when you look at real civil unrest and revolutions, at least within the form, if not the overthrowing of the form itself.
Well, that's when the great boon to the Christian right.
Well, and to every faction who wants any sort of desperate measure taken, I guess.
Right. But the only organized radical faction is on the right. The left is bankrupt in this country.
Yeah, well, that's for sure. And they're certainly not as well-armed as the right, I know that.
No, our backlash is going to be a right-wing backlash. And they're going to be waving the American flag and carrying a Christian cross.
Yeah. All right, well, if we can change the subject a little bit back to the Middle East here, and you make the parallel, and I think it's a good one. I actually am crass and simple enough that I made a bumper sticker years ago that says, "Iraq, America's West Bank," and you compare Iraq and Afghanistan to the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and in their effects on our society here. And I guess I was just wondering if I could get you to explain the metaphor there a little bit, and then if we can sort of segue into what actually is happening in Gaza and the West Bank. It's so little covered even on this show, much less in, you know, the Times and the Post.
Well, you know, if you look at what destroyed Athenian democracy, Athens expanded its empire, became a tyrant abroad, and then eventually a tyrant at home. that the tyranny Athens imposed on others had finally imposed on itself. And that's a pretty good window into what happens when you expand an empire as ruthlessly as we have expanded ours. You've seen the militarization of Israeli society, the seizing of power by, you know, a messianic hard right, Kadima or Likud party, very far from the vision of Israelis founders and who were basically secular socialists in the 1950s. And so that kind of corruption that took place with the occupation of the West Bank in Gaza in 1967 is, I think, affecting American society and the rise of groups like Blackwater and our mercenary forces, as well as the national security state, I think are evidence of that. So, look, what is the FISA Reform Act? It's a giant step towards fascism. It is the ability of the government to monitor private emails, conversations, phone messages of ordinary citizens without appearing to any court, without any kind of oversight. So the consequences of brutal occupations always reverberate on the imperial power throughout history and are already reverberating on us. So just as I have watched over the years the disintegration of the sort of moral fabric of Israeli society, I think we are also undergoing a very similar disintegration. And what's happening in Gaza is an example of that. It's it is just appalling. They're cutting off food, cutting off medical supplies. They have bombed the central power plant, which means many Gazans live in virtual darkness at night with no electricity. Businesses have just collapsed. People, 750,000, half of the residents of Gaza, depend on United Nations donations to eat. And the world stands by and says nothing, does nothing. It is a form of collective punishment, which is a direct violation of the Geneva Convention. And unfortunately, the Israeli lobby in the United States has captured it's powerful, it's wealthy, and it has really silenced any kind of critique of this tremendous abuse from both the Democrats and the Republicans.
Well, and this is, what, revenge for Hamas winning the election that Bush and Rice insisted they hold?
Yeah, I know, which they wanted a free and fair election. They didn't like the outcome. And
these are the birth pangs of a new Middle East, you understand?
All right. The Israelis created Hamas through one blunder after another, just like they created Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. That's the tragedy.
Well, let me ask you about that, because, when you say created in southern Lebanon, created Hezbollah, I take that to mean Hezbollah rose up as a reaction to the Israeli invasion. But in the case of Hamas, I know Richard Sale and others have written that the Israeli intelligence services actually actively worked with Yassin, the old man that they in the wheelchair that they killed with the missile a few years back, in order to create it in the first place. Do you know about that?
I don't know about that. I do know that in the late 80s, when I first went to Gaza, when they were trying to break apart Fatah, they would not arrest Hamas members because they saw Hamas as an effective wedge to Fatah's hegemony over the West Bank and Gaza. To what extent did they create it? It had very strong ties to the Muslim Brotherhood, and a lot of its original leaders had spent time in Egypt with the Brotherhood. But, I don't know. I've heard that accusation, but I've never seen any kind of evidence to back it up.
Well,
the Israelis treated them at the beginning with kid gloves and wanted them to foster.
Well, they certainly had a policy of doing everything they could to marginalize the what are, I guess, essentially kind of leftist secular PLO guys, right? The Fatah movement.
Well, they wanted to break the power structure of Fatah, yeah. And they thought that they could do that by building up Hamas. That was a conscious Israeli policy.
See, that's the thing that I never understand. When you talk about regime change in Iraq or Syria or any of these places, who's left to replace these governments other than religious militant groups?
Well, that's the great failing of U.S. foreign policy. I mean, look at Egypt. You know, these under Hosni Mubarak, who have been in power, 27 years or something? I mean, they have just, and to cling to power, they just become more corrupt and more repressive. You have the same thing in Afghanistan. I mean, I think people, it's not that people want the Taliban. They're just so sick of the brutality and the corruption of the Karzai puppet government, you know, and so that the Taliban begins to look good by comparison.
Right, and if we have a situation in Egypt where Mubarak or maybe his son, who I think he says he's planning on...
Well, he's grooming him. I don't know if it's going to work, but...
I'm sorry?
He's grooming his son, Gamal. I'm not sure it's going to work because he doesn't come out of the army. I think in the end, Egypt's a military state.
Mm-hmm. And well, so do you think that it's a military state enough to keep it from becoming a Muslim Brotherhood state?
I don't know. I mean, Egypt is it has a very efficient secret police and a very brutal one, and that's sort of the glue that's holding the place together. Now, you know, if you get a huge sort of global recession, Egypt can't take a lot more. So I don't know. I haven't been to Egypt for a few years, and but certainly Mubarak's hold on power is one that has really, at this point, is solidified almost solely by force. I mean, he's a deeply hated regime.
Right, and of course, the more cruel he is, the
right.
If
it
there's
fuels,
ever a backlash,
right.
the worse it's
right.
going to be.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing how, I mean, obviously, every time you have one of these, you know, interventions, whether it's just propping up a dictator only, you know, merely propping up a dictator or outright invasions, never mind the fact that you can predict that there will be unpredictable consequences and who knows what. But there are even very, very predictable consequences to pretty much all of this stuff. Like, for example, when they talk about bombing Iran and what might, you know, we can all come off with a list off the top of our head of 10 or 15 horrible things that could very possibly happen if America and or Israel attack that country. And yet somehow it's still, well, on the table, they call it.
Yeah, I've been very outspoken against the calls to bomb Iran for, you know, many reasons, not least of which is that it would trigger a regional war.
Are the people who run American policy just blind and deaf, or how can it really be that the kind of reality that you and I are discussing here doesn't seem to come into play in their deliberations at all up there?
Well, I think in fact on Iran, they've, you know, saner heads in the Pentagon and the CIA have sort of stayed the hand of the Bush administration, and they didn't do that in Iraq, and they paid for it. But the Israelis seem determined to go ahead and do it. I mean, that's the fear now, is that Israel will carry it out on their own, and the consequences are just almost too frightening to contemplate. I think there's little doubt that Iran would strike back against Israel. Hezbollah, which is a Shiite organization, would certainly begin lobbying with everything they have in northern Israel. I mean, it is, you know, the ability of the Iranians to hit U.S. targets in Iraq, including the Green Zone, it is just, it's a nightmarish scenario.
Right, and in fact, I think the last Guardian article that talked about Bush had told the Israelis of, you know, finally know that the main reason cited was the danger to American forces in Iraq.
Yeah. I mean, the Sadr missiles could just devastate the Green Zone. You could obliterate command and control in Iraq.
Well, and never mind the fact that we've installed the Supreme Islamic Council and their Badr Corps in power, and as Abdulaziz al-Hakim has said, you know, we would do our duty to Iran if America
right.
attacked Iran.
Right. And, I mean, Iraq would disintegrate.
Well, but here's the thing that I still can't quite wrap my head around. Why is it that anyone in the Israeli intelligence services or in policy positions there believe that they would be better off by attacking Iran's safeguarded nuclear program when they have to know, as well as you and I do, you know, the obvious consequences, and never mind all the terrible unintended ones that are unpredictable?
Because it's long been Israeli policy that no one else shall have nuclear weapons in the Middle East but Israel, period.
Yeah,
so, and they are willing to suffer the consequences of that. They want a complete domination, I mean, of a nuclear arsenal. So that has been just a, you know, an ironclad Israeli position, which will never change. And they certainly do understand the consequences, but they're willing to take them.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, and I guess they're willing to let American soldiers go ahead and, you know, face the new battle they'll have to face in Iraq, because what do they
well,
care?
Well, it was largely the Israelis, not largely, but certainly the Israelis were pushing us hard to go into Iraq.
Well, and you know, there's some, like Michael Shorey says, has said on this show that, well, and that's why we'll never leave, because the Israelis don't want us to leave. They don't want to have to face the consequences of post-American occupation in Iraq. They want to keep our army there basically forever.
Well, they have nothing to worry about. Obama has no intention of leaving Iraq.
No intention whatsoever.
No.
Well, when he says, well, he wants to get out the combat forces, but not, I guess, the rest of them, do you think
he
means that?
Well, he wants to leave 50 to 60,000 troops behind. He wants to retain control of our imperial city, the Green Zone, the three super bases, leave behind the mercenary forces. That's not a withdrawal.
Do you think that Israeli pressure is a major reason for his decision to...
I don't know about him, but within the Bush administration, that would certainly be true. Yeah. That and the contractors. A lot of people are making a lot of money off this war. Don't forget.
No doubt about
it. For many people, this war has been very, very good.
I guess you saw the profile of Barry McCaffrey in the
New York
Times.
Well, there you go. That's a perfect example.
Yeah, that wasn't really great. I'm sorry it was a few years too late there.
Right.
At your old newspaper. But,
I know.
But still a very good, very thorough report.
Yeah, they did a good job. Yeah.
All right, well, listen, I can't tell you how much I appreciate your time and your insight on the show today, Chris.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, everybody, that is the great Chris Hedges, author of War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, which, please, just put at the top of your list. Buy it for people you care about for Christmas. It's extremely important. Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, senior fellow at the Nation Institute, writes for TruthDig.com, lectures at Princeton. The books are American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America, What Every Person Should Know About War, Losing Moses on the Freeway, and of course, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. And I think we're going to go ahead and call it a day. Call it a wrap for Anti-War Radio. We'll be back.
Next, an excerpt from Dana Milbank's book, Homo Politicus, The Strange and Scary Tribes That Run Our Government. Deep within the forbidding land encircled by the Washington Beltway lives the tribe known as Homo Politicus. Their ways are strange, even repulsive, to civilized human beings. Their arcane rites often impenetrable, their language coded and obscure. Violating their complex taboos can lead to sudden, harsh, and irrevocable punishment. Normal Americans have long feared Homo Politicus, and with good reason, but fearless anthropologist Dana Milbank has spent many years immersed in the dark heart of Washington, D.C., and has produced this indispensable portrait of a bizarre culture whose tribal ways are as hilarious as they are outrageous.
After marginalizing Shinseki, Rumsfeld ignored the warnings he and the other military leaders told their civilian bosses. And the secretary ignored the general's warnings that the army was not big enough to handle the demands of Iraq. In his retirement address in 2003, he cautioned, "Beware the 12-division strategy for a 10-division army." Shinseki got his revenge of sorts at his 40th reunion at West Point in 2005, after it became universally acknowledged that Rumsfeld's occupation force in Iraq was far too small. Shinseki's classmates wore caps with his nickname, declaring, "Rick was right." And half a dozen retired generals, freed from the chain of command, called for Rumsfeld's resignation for ignoring their warnings about the difficulties in Iraq. But Rumsfeld kept his job. Tens, if not hundreds of thousands, died in Iraq, and Shinseki was pushed into retirement. For Potomac Man, telling the truth is a perilous activity. This is true regardless of rank or role. Indeed, Potomac men with less visibility than Shinseki put themselves in much greater danger by telling the truth, particularly if that story contradicts the officially authorized version of events. Halliburton Corporation, the company Vice President Cheney once led, received billions of dollars in government contracts related to the Iraq War without suffering the indignity of going through a competitive bidding process. The Army Corps of Engineers granted Halliburton an emergency contract that lasted 5 years, overruling the agency's chief procurement officer, Bunny Greenhouse, who pointed out that a true emergency contract should not last more than a year. Greenhouse's objections leaked to the media, and she granted interviews. The FBI opened a probe into price gouging, overbilling, and the awarding of no-bid contracts to politically connected companies. When Democratic senators inquired, Greenhouse ignored her boss's warnings and declared, "I can unequivocally state that the abuse related to contracts awarded to KBR, a Halliburton subsidiary, represents the most blatant and improper contract abuse I have witnessed during the course of my professional career." Indeed, Halliburton couldn't justify $1.4 billion in charges to the taxpayers. In other civilizations, Greenhouse would get a commendation for her action. In Potomac Land, Greenhouse lost her job. A few weeks after her public statement, she was removed from the contracting position, banished from the civil service's senior executive ranks, and given a pay cut. The Corps said her demotion was not in retaliation for any disclosures of alleged improprieties. Use of summary executions. Just as the Aztecs used human sacrifice to deter social unrest, what makes Potomac Man's penalty system so frightening is the possibility that virtually any individual can be sacrificed without warning and with no justification. This is possible because of Potomac Man's extensive criminal code, packed with long-forgotten statutes that were written to deal with long-expired emergencies. The Espionage Act of 1917 was a nasty little piece of legislation signed into law by Woodrow Wilson just after the United States declared war on the Kaiser's Germany. It's full of quaint notions from another time. References to coaling stations, telegraphs, code books, signal stations, blueprints, and photographic negatives. It was even dubious at the time, used to imprison conscientious objectors to World War I and to lock up the socialist leader Eugene Debs. It was forgotten about soon after the war and almost never enforced for 90 years. But in recent years, lawyers working for President Bush revived the dusty statute as a way to deter people who leak information to the media and to punish media outlets for publishing the leaked information. They determined that the law makes it possible to prosecute people who even possess classified information, even if they're private citizens.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews and Homo Politicus after these messages.